think we can get started. Erev Tov.
Yes.
And we got a lot to do, even though we always have a lot to do. But considering we're going to have to be missing three of the next four Monday nights because of Yontif. So we'll get in when we can. Please, God, I guess we'll continue in 2 weeks. But then we'll be off for 2 weeks for Sukkos. Anyway, okay, a pleasure. And Vakasha, part three, Rosh Hashanah Librim. We were just talking
part
about
four. Part four.
Part four, yeah, just talking about him now. Over supper. So, you know, but anyways, okay, Vakasha.
And yeah, we're sorry that it's have these breaks, but that's the Jewish calendar, which obviously we don't control. I'm doing the class now from Scranton, Pennsylvania. As we said in the past, there's four important Jewish figures in the 20th century from Scranton. First is Rabbi Zev Gold, important figure, leader of the Mizrahi movement, also the early founder of Yeshivas Torah Vadas, the religious Zionist founder of Yeshivas Torah Vadas, and they named after Rabbi Reines' yeshiva, which was based on Torah Vadas, Torah and secular, like Hershey and secular studies. Of course, if you went to them and told them today, they would think, they wouldn't believe you, but that's the truth. He was rabbi in Scranton. Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, who they brought in later to be the principal of Torah Vadas, from Slovakia, also a big follower of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and Rav Kook. He was rabbi in Scranton as well, founder of Torah Masorah. Harry Wolfson, who together with Lieberman, if you look, let's say, in 1960, the two greatest scholars of Jewish studies in America, you'd say Lieberman and Harry Wolfson. He was from Scranton. And as we mentioned last semester, none other than Rav Tzvi, Rav Herschel Schechter, was born in Scranton. So that's where we're doing it from now, just this week. Thank you all. The date is August 30th, 2020. A few things I want to get to. I have very learned listeners here. With someone wrote me long notes in Hebrew on one of Lieberman's works. So maybe we'll get to some of that. I just want to quickly call attention. Remember at the very first class, we spoke about the article on Minsk, from Lieberman dealing with, where he spoke about when he came to Minsk and the Soviet and the Chazanich was there. If you look in this article, I didn't mention it, so I don't want to go into it, but he does speak about Sobotka. One paragraph, he talks about how he was one of a group of 10 yeshiva students who were chosen to get, let's say, extra money from a donor. And although those yeshiva leadership wanted to split it up among lots of students, the donor, who was a big rabbi, his name is Rabbi Kalmas, he was Rav in Moscow, later in Israel, he wanted to give special preference to the top students. That's the first thing I want to say. Bill Gewirtz, comments, and perhaps correctly, that I sold Daniel Boyarin short when I said he's obviously a genius, but I didn't know if he could do like what Shama Friedman does, critical editions of the Talmud. The truth is, even before Bill emailed me about this, I then remembered that Boyarin's doctoral dissertation, which I'm looking at it right now, it's a critical edition of the Bavli Tractate Nazir. So not only that, but Bill told me that my teacher, Professor Tversky, said that there were only two people in America who could teach academic Talmud. One of them was Boyarin. So I take back what I said. The pictures, which I showed you, which one of the people listening to us gave me, and I'm going to put them in a blog post, and I'm going to give him all the credit, and I thank him. These pictures have now been spread all over the world. And there's such an interest in Shaul Lieberman among Chassidim, among Haredi, among modern Orthodox, all sorts of people. I just give you a couple examples to get a sense of, and it's amazing because none of these people know, until I told them, that the people who started emailing me, and like four people already emailed me saying, did I see these pictures? And I have to tell them that we revealed them for the first time. But let me just show you a couple of things. First of all, if you go to the Otzar Chachma Forum, they reprinted the same ones that, and by the way, I learned that it's not, the Bavver Chassid did not put these names in. He's the one who spread it all over. But someone else, Chaim, who emailed me, he's the one who did this, so give Chaim credit. Incidentally, I don't know who that is there, but right there, that's Rabbi Bernard Mandelbaum. We'll get back to him later. I don't know who that is in the middle. Maybe someone could identify him. We have many people who were at the seminary in those days that you might know. So if you know the Otzer Chachma Forum, it's the Haredi Forum discussing about Sforim and rabbis, and you can read on and on. They're all talking about Lieberman. Of course, half the time they're inventing the wheel. I mean, one of these guys tells a story with Lieberman and the elevator and everything, and nothing to do with Lieberman. You know the story. I told you 10 times. It's with Louis Ginsburg and Alexander Marx. But I mean, you can they're so interested. And one of the people here writes with such pathos that when he sees this picture and he sees Finkelstein and he sees Lieberman, he writes in Yiddish how they were trying their best to try to bring Yiddishkeit, and it's worth seeing. And then look at this. This someone also created this. He turned it into color. So I don't know if that's the color of Heschel's talus. I don't know. Lieberman had red there, but I mean, he look what he did. So, and this has been going around also. So I think this is really interesting. One of the people in the Otzer HaChachma Forum says as follows. He says he doesn't think it's a coincidence that the greatest opponent of modern academic study of Talmud was none other than the Chazon Ish's, was none other than Lieberman's cousin, the Chazon Ish. And Lieberman was the greatest exponent in his day of academic study. And he wonders, is this an accident? Or is there like this family connection here that precisely because Lieberman, his beloved cousin, who he knew so well and thought he could be one of the Gedolei Yisrael, decided to go the academic route, that's what turned the Chazon Ish into such a negative approach, a negative attitude towards academic study. It's interesting. It's worth thinking about. And if anyone wants to see the person who said it, go on the Otzer HaChachma Forum. Two more things. I want to show you, I was looking, we're going to do Hellenism, Jewish Palestine, Greek and Jewish Palestine. I don't know Greek. I don't know Latin either. It's one of my great regrets that I never was not a classics major in college. I took German, took other things, but if you want to know about Greek and Latin in the Talmud, Daniel Sperber gets all the play these days because of his view on partnership minyanim and minhagim. But if you look at his early writings before he moved into these things, the book on minhagim, which made him famous. I mean, we all knew Daniel Sperber. He didn't win his early awards based on minhagim, but the world as a whole, they're not reading about seafaring and shipbuilding in ancient Roman Palestine. And they're not reading about Greek and Latin loanwords and all these sorts of things that Sperber was doing. But he's like one of the experts on Greek and Latin. But and I'll try to find some good examples. But even before getting to Lieberman, and someone asked me last class, class before, to give an example of what I was speaking about. So just coincidentally, this week I'm learning, and lo and behold, I come up with an example. And Lieberman, as far as I can tell, never mentions this example. He doesn't need to mention this example because the Aruch already mentions this. But I want to show you something now which I find really interesting and give you a sense of... hold on a second. This is from Midrash Eicha, the famous story of when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai comes into Vespasian, who's in Eretz Yisrael, and he predicts he's going to be the emperor. A very famous story. But I want to show you something here. The Aruch points this out, but this is the sort of thing that Lieberman did. All you have to do is open up Greek in Jewish Palestine, and he's doing page after page to show you how you can finally understand texts. So here's the story here. It says, Nafak Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Latal, Bechol Sof Shal Espanyas. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai is, going in the army base of Vespasian. He asks, Amaron, Anhu Malka, where's the king? And they went, Azalun v'Amro Espanyas, Chad Yehudi v'el Misha b'shomach. There's a Jew here who wants to speak to you. So Amaron Yete, bring him in. So when he comes in, listen to this. This is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Amarle, Ubiva or Aviva Mare Apaltor. What could that possibly mean? Well, I'll give you a hint, by the way, that because I'm holding the Aruch here, that this word Apaltor is a it's a typo or it's a type copyist error. He didn't know what the copyist didn't know what the word is. The actual word in the manuscripts is imperator, which emperor. Yeah, emperor, exactly. So you can never figure it out from there. And incidentally, this word Mari is also one that they replaced. In the original one, I'll tell you what it is in the middle. But what's this word? I'll give you a hint, by the way. In the original, this is just the Vilna one. If you go back to the manuscripts and now the critical editions, there's no Vav in front of it. So Mari means master, lord or something. We'll see what the original text says. So Lord Emperor. So what would this be?
Biba.
Biba?
Long live.
Long live. There you go. See, V-I-V-E, I guess we'd write today. Vive. I'm told from what I was able to find, maybe we have some Latinists here, that in early Latin, the V is, of course, is pronounced as W, but already by the time of the Midrash, it's pronounced with a V. This is, if you look at it, you'd say B, because, you know, it has a dagesh. It's the beginning of a word. But we know that if you're using a foreign, I don't know who to give credit for that brilliant knowing what it was, but we know that if it's a foreign word, you don't have a dagesh. So, for instance, how do you say philosopher in Hebrew? It's not philosoph, although I remember seeing years ago some people used to transliterate that way. It's philosoph because it's a word in a foreign language. So the actual Latin is, and I'm looking at it, the Aruch here, it's Vive Domini Imperator, so which we can translate it as long live or live, O Lord Emperor. So here's an example, and they couldn't use a Vav, because I'm certain that when the Midrash was written, the Vav would have been pronounced W. So they use a Beis. And it's Vive, it shouldn't be Mari, it should be Domini. If you look in the Aruch, they preserve that. So here you have an example of, if you didn't have the Aruch, you would have to wait maybe for someone like Lieberman to tell us what that is. And my final comment two more things I want to show you. Just the Yerushalmi Kipshuto. I had a mark here in it. I didn't mention it to you. He has so many insights, but one of the things he points out is that in the Yerushalmi, before the copyist changed it, if you look at the original, they didn't use the expression Talmud Chacham. Instead, they used the expression Talmid Chachamim, student of the wise, in plural. And that's a trend in Yerushalmi, student of the wise, which probably makes more sense because who ever heard of students of only one person? It's very unusual. Most people are students of more than one. So Talmid Chachami. The last point I want to mention is about the Talmud of Caesarea that I briefly mentioned last time. And basically he said, as I told you, that The three bavas were originally one masechta. It says in the Gemara, the Nezikin chad masechta. So these, and what is Lieberman? I don't think I really explained it well. What he does is he shows that there's Amoraim who are only mentioned in this masechta, different languages, different masechta, and other things. And he argues basically that for a variety of reasons that it was composed in Caesarea. Now, later, I'm going to get to this book. I mention this only because I just got back to Scranton, so I have my other books here. It says, why there was never a Talmud in Caesarea, Saul Lieberman's mistakes. We will have to speak about the relationship of Neusner and Lieberman, because despite what Neusner said, he was a big student of Lieberman. You can go to the Lieberman archive now, and you can see letters from Neusner, fawning letters to Lieberman. But after Lieberman's final article, which appears posthumously, in which he blasts Neusner, then Neusner, he goes one step further. He publishes an entire book against Lieberman, and he says in the introduction that Lieberman's one ambitious monograph is full of obvious errors of method, blunders of logic, and above all, failures systematically and conscientiously to accomplish the task of serious research. If I had in a single sentence to summarize all of Lieberman's intellectual blunders, they come down to one thing. The analytical acumen characteristic of the Talmud does not shape Lieberman's analytical imagination. So we will come back when we deal with the impact of Lieberman. Of course, we'll have to look at Neusner and if there's any validity to what he says. Granted, you're dealing with the equivalent of a pygmy compared to a giant, but that doesn't mean that he might not have had some points. But he says in the preface here that this book, the title of it is Saul Lieberman's Errors. He says, I'm not doing it because I have any grudge or anything. I'm just, this is the area of scholarship. No special animus motivates this, he says. And he includes in here an essay by a professor. Did Saul Lieberman know Latin or Greek? So obviously there was plenty of animus. You don't publish an entire book going, and he was able to, Neusner, because he had all this funding at Scholars Press, and whatever he wanted to publish, he could publish. And when we deal with Neusner, I'll show, he has the world record in academic publications. I don't know who is non-academic, but he has like something like 1,000 books. So we will return to Neusner later on. But now we are, incidentally, the Aruch I mentioned, this takes back to medieval times, Nathan ben Echilo wrote. Okay, we are now going back, picking up with our story. Got to keep track of all our stuff here. Going to see lots of interesting things today. I think it's interesting, and I'm happy to say that lots of other people think it's interesting, judging by all the comments I'm getting. So I'm really at the thank Rabbi Kelman again for encouraging me to do these classes. So now we're Lieberman. He's in Eretz Yisrael, where we left off. He was at the Hebrew U. He's teaching at the Hebrew U. He earns his master's. He's already started to publish. Everyone knows he's a Talmudic genius. In 1934, this is where he's not working at Harry Fischel, which we'll talk about in a minute. 1934, he publishes an article in Haaretz, the newspaper Haaretz, called Le Yovro Shel Professor Ginsburg, that is the Jubilee of Louis Ginsburg. And this is an appreciation of Louis Ginsburg's scholarship. The great Louis Ginsburg, who was Talmudist at the seminary for decades already, they had started correspondence in the late 1920s. And it's natural, as we will see, that Ginsburg invites him. It's Ginsburg's the reason they invited him. It was technically, it would have been Finkelstein. But they had this correspondence, and Lieberman had great, although their religious outlook would be very different, he had great respect for Louis Ginsburg and what he achieved. And only someone who identified with an academic type of orthodoxy could write such an article. When you think about it, it's incredible that after such an article, you're praising someone who really is a conservative Jew and a leader of the conservative movement. And yet we'll see what position he has. And he's still among the Gedolei Yisrael, the great Torah sages of Jerusalem. We spoke last class about his writings, his beginning on Tosefta. We're going to come back to it later when we deal with Tosefta Kivchuta. He also wrote a work during these years called Tashlum Tosefta. The classic edition of Tosefta is called the Zuckermandel edition. And they reprinted it in Jerusalem in 1937. And Lieberman has a long, it's basically an introduction to Tosefta. So that's an important work. And then in 1939, and we're going ahead of ourselves a little bit, then we're going to come back to the Harry Fischel Institute in a second. But in 1939, he publishes the book I showed you last class, Shekian. Here it's connected. At the same time, he published a work on Yemenite Midrashim preserved in Yemen, Midrashay Taiman. And this is maybe my favorite work of his. Lieberman wrote a number of these little books, and he did not regard these as his most serious work. This is sort of like when he was tired doing other things. His major work, where he spent most of his time, were his commentaries on Yerushalmi, on Tosefta, things he wrote on Bavli. But even his great works, Hellenism, Jewish Palestine, and Greek and Jewish Palestine, these were side ventures, I guess you could say. But I love this book because one of my great interests is I'm interested in how non-conventional, non-traditional ideas have made it into our tradition, both rabbinic non-traditional and even things that come from outside the tradition that have made it in. I mean, all you got to do is, you know, the red ribbons. Everyone always talk about the red ribbons. There's a perfect example, the Tosefta. Lieberman deals with it in the Tosefta. This is Darchei Amori. It's they call it an idolatrous thing. So we have many, many examples of things that have come into our tradition. And he takes this up, but he takes this up for a very specific reason, because he's looking, we have medieval Kare texts, we have Christian texts, and we have apostate literature where they attack their former religion, and various midrashim are quoted in all these sources in order to make Jews look bad. Many people have said that these are false, they're forgeries, they can't be true. Even the Abarbanel says this. And yet Lieberman argues that in case after case, it's not true. These are preserved. We find these in various midrashim. You're going to say they're strange, they're weird. Well, welcome to Midrash. There's all sorts of strange things in Midrash and are not conventional, not even mainstream or accepted. It's precisely because of that, that Nachmanides, and Lieberman takes this up as well, famously in his disputation in Barcelona, where Pablo Cristiani, who's citing various Midrashim that are also cited earlier by this Raymond Martini, this person who's attacking Judaism, when pushed against the wall, as it were, because you have passages that speak about the birth of the Messiah, all sorts of things like that, in other words, it already happened. What the Ramban says is that I'm not obligated to defend all these midrashim, that midrashim are like sermons, that you could have midrashim that are just not accepted, that they're one person's opinion. The Rambam says the same thing. He says, what about these Agadata that speak about astrology? He says that, well, first of all, maybe you can reinterpret it to mean something else. But at the end of the day, if it definitely refers to astrology, so it's from one of the rabbis, one of the great sages, who was mistaken about astrology. He was led astray. That's a common view among the sages of the Sephardic tradition. There were people who argued that, no, Nachmanides, he couldn't have meant what he said, that when he denied the binding authority of the Midrashim, he was just doing it as a... as an apologetic technique to try to defend the tradition so that Jews would not be led astray. Lieberman argues, no, absolutely not. This is what the Ramban believed, and he follows in good tradition. The whole Gaonic tradition views Midrash. It's hard today for people who go to yeshivas and Midrashim. Every Midrash is regarded as absolutely binding and of divine authorship, divine inspiration, things like that. That's not the approach of the sages from Spain and the Gaonic tradition, who distinguished between halacha and agadah. As Nachmanides says, you're not bound to agadah. Of course, if you have a certain agadot deal with principles of faith, those are different. But we're talking about individual opinions said by a rabbi. This is actually very helpful because people sometimes call attention. They'll say, well, this maybe has a negative view of women. We already saw last semester. Remember of Yaakov Kapel Schwartz? I showed you the picture of me and him at the wedding a few weeks ago. This great, great Torah sage from Satmar. But what a mind, Ishesh Golot. He said himself, he said that in some of these Midrashim, our approach has to be like the Rambam says, that this is not our tradition. So we recognize the Midrash is there, it's said, but this is not the tradition that we follow. So we're going to put it on the side. Of course, we respect the rabbi who said it, but it's not ours. It's not our tradition. And we don't need to defend it, to justify it, because we follow other great rabbis who have a different approach. And so Lieberman elaborates on this in the, he has an English introduction here, which, he's called Rabbi Hesol Lieberman, Dean of the Harry Fishel Institute, Jerusalem. We'll speak about the Harry Fishel Institute in a minute. But he actually, one of the examples of this is that, he mentions this in the English preface, according to one of the Kari traditions, the Jewish calendar was definitively fixed by Rabbi Gamliel. Now, we assume the Jewish calendar is much later fixed. Hillel fixed it, not Rabbi Hillel, not Hillel, the great Hillel, but the later Hillel. I was going to say Rabbi Hillel, but Hillel's never called Rabbi. Hillel's not, he's not viewed as Rabbi. His there's a Rabbi Hillel, who's mentioned. In fact, talk about Midrashim that are unusual. This Rabbi Hillel has one famous passage. He says he doesn't believe in the coming of the Messiah because the Jews already enjoyed the Messiah in the days of Chizkiyahu. So, but this is not Hillel. This is Rav Hillel that we don't know if he's a Tana. We don't know if he's an Amora. Brandeis University, my alma mater, the Hillel of Brandeis University, on their literature for years. I told them about this many times. I don't know if they've changed it. But, you know, if I'm not for myself, who is for me? You know, they quote Rabbi Hillel, not Hillel. So everyone was arguing that this is nonsense. It's not nonsense. He shows that there was a letter of a Palestinian Gaon recently discovered, lo and behold, who has this tradition also. So I think the upshot of Shekian is that many things, we see these medieval passages and you look at them and say, this is strange, where does this come from? Many of these can actually be found sources for. In fact, we will get back to this when we deal with Lieberman and his dispute with Seitlin, because we all know, we're told, everyone knows this, that originally we had Kiddush HaChodesh. And only when you didn't have Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctifying the new moon with the witnesses, then all of a sudden we have to have a calendar. Wouldn't you know it? It's not true. According to everyone, Rav Sadia Gaon said that the calendar was the original way of doing it. And this becomes then a dispute between Lieberman and Seitlin. We'll get to it. So many unusual views, not mainstream views, they can find sources among the great, the Gaonim, the Rishonim. Sometimes these views are so strange, that's why they were pushed out, and we don't know about them. But we have all sorts of interesting positions. And so I highly recommend anyone interested in this to look at Shkian. I mean, he deals with, there's some passages that talk about that in the Messianic era, non-Jews will be obligated in certain commandments. Again, the Abarbanel says it's nonsense that they made it up, the apostates, but it's not nonsense. And one other point I want to mention about this book is that in Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, I publish a letter in the back to Ginsberg, and Lieberman reveals something very interesting. Lieberman writes about this work, Shir Koma. There's a work called Shir Koma, which presents God's body literally in gigantic form. Now, is this to be taken literally? Not. The Rambam says that this work, Shir Koma, should be destroyed. And it's, you know, it's not an authentic text. But many people thought it was an authentic text. But Lieberman says to Ginsberg that he hints that Shir Koma, what's in there, comes out, as he says, he hints that it comes maybe perhaps from some sectarian, non-Jewish, pagan literature. But he says to Ginsberg, I only hinted to this. Why not? Why only hint to it? Quote, because I didn't want to insult those who believe in perfect faith in the holiness of Shir Koma. He doesn't want, although he's assuming probably it comes from, you know, some pagan influence, this, at least for certain Mekubalim, Shir Koma became an important text. The fact that the Rambam says it's terrible, they weren't concerned about that. But Lieberman is concerned about the simple faith of people. He doesn't want to insult them. So he hints to this. And I think that this is following the path of Rav Kook. Rav Kook states that if you know something is true, even if you know it's true, but you could negatively affect the Judaism of someone else, don't say it. You don't need to say it. Not everyone needs to know all the truths. The example I always give is you don't go into Mea Shearim and start talking how Torah and Darwin could be joined together, as Rav Kook did, because these people never heard of Darwin. This is just not their world. So Rav Kook sets forth the idea. I guess it's an elitist idea. But every rabbi knows that there are certain things you say from the pulpit, that you say privately in a class, you wouldn't say from the pulpit. And Kal Vachomer, you wouldn't say from the pulpit next week, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when the shul is really packed. Because like another movie, you know, not everyone can handle the truth. Not everyone, you know, not everyone is at the place to appreciate these things. So And that's what Lieberman was saying. I'm not going to specifically openly start talking about Shear Coma, where it came from, but I'm hinting to it. That's what he tells Ginsburg. I find that very interesting. That's very Maimonidean. That was the Rambam's approach. The Rambam is an overt elitist in which he says that not everyone is entitled to all the truth. First, you have to fill your belly with Talmud, and then you have to study the philosophy, and then you can be enlightened into the truth. But people who haven't, see, we're here together. Everyone's coming out on Monday night. You're all ready to be enlightened. I can give all the truths. I'm going to give you one in a few minutes. But the Rambam says that the average person, you can't reveal these things to them. And the Rambam himself says in the guide, he's going to hint to certain truths, but he's not going to say it openly. And that's exactly what Lieberman does. He hints to the truth that the Shear Coma here was influenced by these non-Jewish texts and some of its formulations, but he's not going to say it openly. Very interesting. Another book he published right during this time. I don't know when he was able to. This is between day and night, because all day he's learning. He has a letter which he writes to, I think it's to Ginsburg, in which he talks about when he learned Yerushalmi. He said, the beautiful Jerusalem nights. But I assume it's not only at night, it's during the day. He's learning and writing his commentaries, but he somehow finds time. He writes another book, Yemenite Midrashim. Same, it's good they joined them together here, because it's the same sort of theme. What do I mean by that? Because the Yemenite Midrashim, I'll read you actually what he says here. On page 20, he writes about how in the Yemenite Midrashim, first of all, they do preserve all sorts of true Jewish traditions, but he says there's a number of examples where all sorts of strange stuff were put in the Yemenite Midrashim, of not only of like preachers who invented this stuff, but he even thinks there's material in here, and you can see on pages 26 and on, he thinks there's parodies of Chazal. Things that came from, he calls them the korop suin, which he says perhaps carrots. He's not the first to say it in general, but he gives case after case where he thinks that these are not real midrashim. Because if you look at them carefully, they're obviously, they're mocking rabbinic Judaism. So he thinks that somehow they, over the years that they were by ignorant people in Yemen, they were just absorbed into the tradition. And I've mentioned in the past, there was a rabbi, he was the Rav of Amsterdam. His name was Yosef Tzvi Dunner, the Dunner family that you know in Rabbi Pinny Dunner of Los Angeles and other Dunners. They're all from this family. He was the Av Beis Din of Amsterdam, a huge Talmid Chacham, but he had all sorts of radical ideas in terms of how to understand Talmud. When it came to halacha, everything was traditional. But when it came to Talmud study, he was a critical scholar, so he would show how maybe sometimes the Mishnah is not what the Talmud says it is, that the Pshat and Mishnah is different. But that's not what got his book almost put in Cheirim. The Jews in Frankfurt, the Frankfurt Orthodox wanted to put his book, Commentary on Talmud, in Cheirim. And this is published by Mossad Rav Kook, and this is the Rav of Amsterdam, a huge Hambahav. Now, why did they want to? Not because of his academic study, because already the Tosas Yom Tov speaks about that and other things that you can offer a different interpretation. Even the Vilna Gaon, they offer a different interpretation of the Mishnah than the Gemara, because he says that there's a couple examples in the Talmud where heretical statements made it into the Talmud without people realizing it. Now, think what this is saying here. All the great rabbis of the generations who've studied this, they didn't know about this. And you, Rabbi Dunner, you know about this. It's making the Rishonim and the Achronim look like they were taken in. And what were the two famous examples he gives? And he's open the possibility there's other examples. One of the stories is that there's a case in the Gemara about where if a woman falls off a roof and she has sex with a man on the way down, and you know what her status is. So you might say, well, it's a you don't ask a kasha from a maisa, you know, this is what happened. But no, Dunner says this is an example of Karaites or other people mocking the rabbis, coming up with such a crazy case like this. And somehow it got pushed in the Gemara, and he thinks it's terrible. He thinks it's mock. And he gave a few examples, but these are the ones I like best. The other example he gave is there's a story. Is it Rav? I think it's Rav. He would come to a town and he would say, I need a woman for a night. And We know that this is can be understood in the Babylonian context. Yaakov Ellman wrote about this. Even to this day in Iran, Shia Muslims have this whole conception of, I guess it's sort of like legalized prostitution, but it's a wife for a night. But Rabbi Dunner thought that this is disgrace. It's mocking the great Amora, and that this was done by one of the heretics. And somehow, unfortunately, it got put into our texts. But Lieberman thinks that you have this with Midrashim of Yemen. And one of the big Midrashim from Yemen is Midrash HaGadol, it's called, which is put together, they say, in the 14th century by David Adeni. And why do I mention this? Because lo and behold, I found one, and Lieberman doesn't mention this, which I think maybe this is exactly another example of what Lieberman's talking about. Let me show you. And then, lo and behold, Rabbi Dessler independently says the exact same thing, that this can't be authentic. So, but this is, Lieberman gives example after example. But I want to give you this one because it's very easy to see. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Rabbi Dessler's wrong. Maybe this is not put in by the outsiders. I don't know. This is Midrash HaGadol. And before I even explain it, just... I had seen this years ago, and when I did a blog post on it, and I wanted to copy the book. I don't have the Midrash HaGadol. This is the Sheinzelt edition. So I ordered it from Interlibrary Loan. Lo and behold, the copy I get is from Judah Golden. It's a personal library. It has his book plate on the inside. Judah Golden, also an important person in the Jewish Theological Seminary, and he marked this very passage. So what does it say here? It's... Here's the, we'll begin from here. It's quoting a pasuk in Eel, where it says, Umayim tiken bamida, that is, he meets out, talking about God, God meets out the waters by measure. I'm not sure how they derive the midrash, the teaching. Someone once explained it to me, but I don't really remember. I tried to figure it out, but it's not important how they actually derive it. Umayim tiken bamida, what does this refer to? The Mayim? Zotorah. This refers to Torah, Shinim Shalabamayim. Referred to as by water. What's the proof for this? Shinemar Hoy Kolt Sameh Lachulamayim. Everyone who's thirsty, go to drink water. And you could say water here refers to thirsty for Torah, but look at the lesson he derives in this midrash. What does this teach you? Lamdacha? Shekoha Lomeid Mimena Yuter Midai Sof Shehu Yotzei Leminut. This pasuk teaches us, again, I'm not sure how they derive it, it teaches us that if you learn Torah too much, the end is that it'll bring you to heresy. And Steinsaltz, in his note, before Steinsaltz did Gemara, he did a Midrash HaGadol, he says, Mekoro Ne'elam, we don't know where this source comes from. This is quite subversive here. You're saying that if you learn, it's good to learn Torah, but if you learn too much Torah, that's going to lead to heresy. Could that have actually been said by one of the great rabbis? Or is this like a skeptical sort of comment that somehow made its way in? As I said, Rabbi Dessler, I was quite surprised to see Rabbi Dessler. In Rabbi Dessler's letters, he was learning this, and he himself said, well, it has to be in, by some heretic. But I don't know, maybe not. Maybe this is a, as I just said before, the rabbis can say all sorts of unusual things in the Midrash. Maybe this is a mainstream rabbi who's saying, you know, take it easy. Don't learn too much where it can lead to. Incidentally, in the note of Judah Golden, he thinks he has a source. He says he cites the Targum to Bamidbar 22:5, where it says, Bilam acted foolishly, it says, from the greatness of his wisdom. Bilam's so wise, that's why he acted foolishly. It was his great wisdom that led him to think he could curse the Israelites. But this refers to general wisdom. It's not referring to Torah. Where else do we find that don't learn too much Torah? Other than the fact that you have in, and this is a certain skeptical passage, of making books, there is no end in one of the Megillas. But we assume there that Koheles is going back and forth, you know, not knowing exactly which direction to go until at the end he concludes, you know, the proper way to live. But if you look, you have all these skeptical passages in Koheles because it's almost like we're watching a bout, like a boxing match. And, you know, he has the ups and downs of faith. So he has these nihilistic feelings that nothing is new. But then, of course, this is challenged by another another opinion until at the end you get the end, the final. But it's striking. And I don't know of any other rabbinic passages like this that says Torah is good, but too much Torah, that you want to keep away from. In Changing the Immutable, I gave another example of a Midrash Aleph Beitz, it's called, where it was published by Roy Wertheimer, Shlomo Aharon Wertheimer, and he took out passages of the Midrash because, one of them, the whole passage where this, it reads as follows. Satan says to God, "You created heaven, I created earth. You created the firmament, I created the deep. You created animals, I created demons." And in the end, God says to him, you say you created Gehenna, so I'm going to send you to Gehenna. But this is like a dualistic passage here that Satan created the bad things. And so we understand why Rabbi Wertheimer wouldn't publish it, but it's in the Midrash. We only found it when they published a critical edition. So what to make of that? It could enlarge our understanding of what the rabbis, you had rabbis who were comfortable with dualistic language, perhaps. I'm not going to get into them now. It's a different topic, but you have all sorts of unusual passages. And Lieberman's point was, although he acknowledged that sometimes he thinks they come from Karaites and sectarian literature, but many, many cases he shows, that these are, if you go up to someone and say to them that, in the Messiah, there won't be mitzvos anymore, or we won't have to do mitzvos. They say, you're a Christian. And yet I can show you plenty of rabbinic passages that say the same thing, that in the Messianic era, some people assume that's only after Tichias HaMeisim, whatever it means, but they say Atid Torah, in the future, the Torah will be Mechadesh, there'll be a new Torah. And Shabtai Tzvi was able to, he changed the bracha from Matir Asurim, to free the prisoners, to Matir Isurim. And he was able to do that because this is a long rabbinic tradition that in the future, there won't be the holidays anymore. There won't be also. So now, granted, you have others who reject this, but these are all found as well. Okay, let's get back to our story. In 1935, Lieberman is given a position. There's an institute that was established in Jerusalem called the Harry Fischel Institute. And he is appointed dean of the Harry Fischel Institute in 1935. So what's the Harry Fischel Institute? Let me show you some pictures here. Harry Fischel is an incredible person. Harry Fischel was, it's before there were Orthodox billionaires. Even with inflation, I don't think he's a billionaire, but certainly worth hundreds and hundreds of millions with taking into account inflation. Now we have lots of Orthodox multimillionaires and billionaires, but in those days you didn't have many of them. Harry Fischel, he comes from Russia with nothing. You can read all about him in this book. Once again, this wonderful book, Harry Fischel, Pioneer of Jewish Philanthropy. Look how thick this is. It was his memoirs, which were edited by his son-in-law, Rabbi Herbert Goldstein. Let me get back now. I want to show you some Harry Fischel. He comes to America with nothing. And unlike so many others who felt forced to work on Shabbos, he starts working. Every time he says you have to work on Shabbos, he works 6 days and then or 5 days, and then he has to have a new job. He is a self-made man out of nothing. He starts investing in real estate and becomes a not only very, very wealthy, but an unbelievable Baal Tzedakah, giving tzedakah not just in America, but in Israel as well. Here's a road, a street in Israel named after him, Yisrael Aharon Fischel. His son-in-law, by the way, Herbert Goldstein, is a musmach of the seminary. But he's one of the leading Orthodox rabbis in America. His daughter marries with Shari Yashav Cohen, who then takes over the Fischel Institute, the Rav of Haifa. But he then gets Orthodox smicha. It shows you in that era that how Orthodox and conservative were similar to a certain extent. But as I said, he comes in 1885 with no money. And you can read all about it in the... He's a carpenter's assistant, and then he went to night school to learn English, and he owned tenements and buildings on Park Avenue. I'm going to show you something in a minute. And by the way, he closed down his business on Shabbos. We have lots of multimillionaire and billionaire Orthodox builders. Do they shut down on Shabbos and holidays? I don't think so. Maybe they do. Some do. Reichman used to. You can find a terrarium, I guess. official shut it down. And this is an era where 6-day work week was very common. He paid his worker, what they used to do was, it was 5.5 weeks. They used to work half a day on Saturday. He paid his workers for the half day on Saturday. These are non-Jewish workers. He paid them the half day on Saturday, even though they weren't working. What an incredible person. And by the way, they allowed Jews to work for him as well. Everyone got paid, but he allowed Jews to work for him at the Shomer Shabbos company. I'm going to show you all the great stuff he did, how important he is. But before I even do that, I just have to read you something. I'm so happy this book wasn't published by Art Scroll, because I'm going to read you something now, and it's amazing how they put it in. But it's the time. It's on page 435, 436. His wife dies somewhat young, and then he remarries. In Israel, he meets Eretz Yisrael. He meets this woman who's the daughter of Rabbi Aaron Hyman. He was a rabbi in London. He wrote a number of sarim, including famous Toldos Tanayim v'Marayim. And he speaks about how he courted her, and she agreed to marry him, and they had to explain to his children that he's going to be married because they told him he'd wait a year, and it didn't. It's really very interesting. But, and then they announce, right when he's about to leave Israel, and they're going to be engaged now, he says as follows. They have all these speeches to say goodbye to official as he goes back to America. As soon as the last speech was finished, I left the men and entered the ladies' room. And in the presence of every man and woman, I came over to my intended bride and kissed her in the presence of the guests. So our engagement was announced. We understand it's a touching, romantic scene here from a person who's not really very learned, but very committed to Torah Judaism. In that era, I told someone that when the young Israel were having dances, that there's a problem to have a dance. So that's what he writes. And so very nice. He writes it and they don't censor it out. Very interesting. But then there's something which I don't understand. I don't understand it. It appears here and it deals with Rav Kook. Because Rav Kook, when it came to men and women matters, he was so stringent. In some ways, he's more, and his students are more extreme than the Haredim, you know, these the Dati Lumi types. The women don't wear skirts down to the knee. The skirt has to go all the way to the ground. And Rav Kook had very conservative views. But listen to this passage. It's one thing to do with Harry Fischel. He's a very pious Jew, a good Jew, doesn't know so much about halacha, perhaps. Although his descendants, look who his descendants are. This is Rav Kook. He says he wanted Rav Kook to meet his fiance. The doctor at first refused to permit such an excitement that he wanted to go in and get a bracha. Because Harry Fischel, he comes to Israel, he gives all this money to Merkaz Rav, he builds the house for Rav Kook. If you go to the house of Rav Kook in Jerusalem now, it's built by Harry Fischel. The doctor at first refused to permit such an excitement, but this was his desire, that is Rav Kook's desire, and I brought my bride to him. He had met her in her father's home in London. He took my hand and asked me to hold her hand and gave us the priestly blessing. This was the last time I was privileged to see this great sage of Israel, who was responsible for the organization of the Harry Fischel Institute for Research in Talmud. So Rav Kook is telling Harry Fischel to hold his fiance's hand so he can give him a bracha? I guess maybe he knew that she was past childbirth age and everything, so technically it's not such an issue, but it's still very strange, and I don't know what to make of this. And I'm thinking that maybe he walked in, Harry Fischel walked in holding her hand. Now we know, why do I say this? Because Rav Kook, it's famous. So when people would come to him, if they weren't wearing a yarmulke, he would tell them, don't put on a yarmulke. You know, he wants them to see, you know, who they are. So if Harry Fischel comes in holding her hand for the bracha, maybe Rav Kook was thinking, I don't want them to be pious on my account. Maybe, but it's a strange passage. So what does Harry Fischel do? How does he get to Israel? Well, even before he gets to Israel, he's a major figure in Yeshiva College. Here's a picture of him at the what is this? This is 1928, dedicating the new building, the big building at YU. That's official right there. And next to him, can I enlarge this a little bit? Can I enlarge it? I don't know. But okay, there's Fischel. You see my cursor. Next to him is the Ramaz, Moshe Zvulun Margulis. That's the school is named after him, the father of Joseph Lookstein. I want to show you something though. And I think you'll get a kick out of this, especially if some people live in New York. Oh, here's the thing. You see how even after Rav Kook died, Harry Fischel was the treasurer. Harry Fischel was, you can read about in the book, how YU was in deep financial distress and how he was able to not only give an enormous amount of money himself, he was able to get all the rich Orthodox Jews, you see some of them in the picture right there, to donate a lot of money and save YU. But I want to show you his house. Harry Fischel's house. It's still standing in New York. I think we have people in Manhattan. I don't know if we have anyone on the east side. I remember I told you he did a lot on Park Avenue. Well, here is Park Avenue and 80th Street. Here is the building he built. You can see it's 14 stories, I believe. But now I want to take you forward here. Move sideways, the modern technology. Oops, hold on. Turn around. Yes, let me go forward a bit. A little more. A little more. Okay, now I want to go sideways. Okay. Okay, you see this here? Actually, I wasn't sure if it would work so well, so I got a better picture waiting for me here. This is 80th and Park. Here's it. It's down. Yeah, go down. You have parking. This is where Harry Fischel lived, the second floor. And look above. What's going on here? Why is he living here? Why isn't he living over here in the building? And why isn't he, why up top is nothing built here?
His sukkah.
His sukkah, exactly. Is that Mel? If that's Mel Shkoyach, I want to read you what the book says. This is great. It has on page 370 in the book. Listen to this. It's the first sukkah on Park Avenue. In accord with Jewish law, it talks about how you have to view so it can't be obstructed. The new apartment that he built was a 14-story building, his residence occupying the second floor. In order that the sukkah should comply with the Jewish law and the roof be exposed to the sky, Mr. Fischel omitted one room on each of the 12 floors of the structure above his own apartment on the second floor, entailing a loss of rentals about $12,000 a year. And then it says he never regretted that. And there's a picture in the book here of the building. You can see it here. And right here is where I showed you, but that's where the parking lot is now. And when you think how much money to have a sukkah, he was willing to give up, not just this year, every year, 12 floors of rent. It's so impressive. I'm curious here now. Figure 1930. They're saying $12,000. Hold on. I'm going to tell you what the inflation calculator says this would be. I don't know how accurate this is, but it's saying that that's almost $200,000 a year in $12,000. So $12,000 then is $200,000 now, but it would be more because today on rents are more. But so that's who Harry Fischel was. So he went to Eretz Yisrael a couple times, more, I think four times. He also went back to visit his mother, his town. And he had lots of money. He could do what he wants. So he goes to Israel and he immediately is taken with Rav Kook. And he says, we have to support Rav Kook. We have to support his yeshiva. We want to give him a place to live. And then he comes up with this idea, how he comes up, well, I guess we'll talk next class, of an institute. And I'll read you what Rav Kook, I'll read you now, actually, if we have time. An institute where you're going to take top Talmidei Chachamim. And I'll show you some, one of the they put out a volume of, here, they put out a volume one of the years. Here's just some of them. If you know Rabbinic Jerusalem, these are some of the great Torah scholars. But there are many Torah scholars you don't have here in this. If you know the history of Talmidei Chachamim in Jerusalem, you know them because they wanted, Rav Kook says as follows. What is this new institute? He has a yeshiva, Merkaz HaRav, traditional Talmud study. But he wants something more than that for some special people. He says this is found as a passage. It comes from Rav Kook's notebooks. Rav Ari Shvat, who's given Torah in Motion classes, has an article, The Connection of Rav Kook with Shaul Lieberman. And he says this new institute, which they call the Harry Fishel Institute, is not just to be a place for Talmidei Chachamim. And then he explains that we know there's great Talmidei Chachamim and there's great academic scholars, but we want that. But the academic scholars, they don't do it for the sake of Torah. It's just like another thing to study. It's not L'shem Shemayim. He says, however, we are going to put them together, join them. Why? Because everything that is included in what we call Chachmas Yisrael, Heine Gufei Torah, this is also Torah. That is what Lieberman is doing is also Torah. So Rav Kook, he's not trying to uproot and trying to get rid of the traditional yeshiva, but on the contrary, he's trying to, together with the traditional yeshiva, take people who are huge Talmidei Chachamim from the old school and put them in an institution like Harry Fishel, where for half a day, they're going to be traditional Torah students. And then they will try to, from a L'shem Shamayim, try to bring the best insights like Lieberman did in the, to try to create a sort of like a kosher academic approach. And we'll talk about some of what they achieved and some of what they accomplished next class. The Institute was founded before Lieberman came. It was founded in 1932, and Rav Kook's younger brother, Rav Dov Kook, was the first director, but they needed a dean. They needed someone. Rav Shai Yashav Cohen said they needed someone who could instruct these Talmidei Chachamim. These are people who knew, like, you can look at what they had to know. They had to be expert in three orders of Talmud. They had to be able to write halachic shuvot, things like that. You can even see in English, because Miotzer Chachma, if you just put in Sefer Yovel, Harry Fishel, they have an English section in which they have a whole like constitution of what the purpose of the institution is and what the level of the students who had to be there was. So they needed someone like Lieberman to open their eyes. So I guess you call it the academic, the modern approach. Dov Kook was the director, but he's the fundraiser and organizer. And then you have the person who runs it from day to day, the Rosh Hashiva, I guess you would call him, is Lieberman. They call him the dean. In the Hebrew, they called him Rosh. I guess like Rosh Hashiva. Dov Kook. He's not known as a great Torah scholar. I mean, he's a Talmid Chacham, of course, but he's not famous. He didn't write Svarim, anything like that. But he's known for another reason. He had a son who he named Hillel Kook. Hillel Kook is better known for us. So which of our learned people knows what Hillel Kook is known for?
Peter Bergson.
There you go. Peter Bergson, who did not die that long ago. He fell into obscurity, I think. I'll tell you exactly. I was shocked when I think it might have been from Hillel Halkin, even. He dies in 2001, but he was in obscurity for the end of his life. And for those who don't know who Peter Bergson is, he comes to America and he works together with Ben Hecht and Roy Rogers Jr., the congressman, all to try to raise the rabbis, to try to raise the conscience of the American Jewish community and the American community about what's going on in Europe with the Holocaust. They put on a whole production that was at Madison Square Garden, went all over America. And this was Peter Bergson. And
takes issue with Rabbi Wise, a big opponent of Rabbi Wise.
Yes, yes.
Wise not doing enough. Wise at the year of FDR and did nothing.
Yes, that was his claim. It's not for us now to get into the issue of Stephen Wise, but definitely their point was...
Rayful Madoff is the same thing. He wrote a book about it, Rayful Madoff.
Yeah, so that's Peter Bergson and the Bergson boys. I forget exactly they had a term for them, but he gets, though he wasn't a religious Jew, but he has great zechuyot for what he did during the war. And incidentally, this led... raising the awareness and everything, the War Refugee Board. So it's not just, talking in the wind. This had practical effects in trying to, raise the concerns of what was going on. Stephen Wise and others, they were very close to FDR. They were Morgan Fowle. They were reluctant to, use their relationship too much to go to him and really press this issue. So we will end with there today. We did a lot. Well, next class, we'll get into this Harry Fishel Institute, what Lieberman was doing. He accomplished great things in the Harry Fishel Institute, but believe it or not, while he's at the Harry Fishel Institute, he gets an invitation. Out of left field, you might think, or at least they thought it was out of left field, an invitation to come to the United States, to leave the Holy Land, and to join a non-Orthodox institution. Why was he given this invitation? How could he even consider doing this? And in the end, why did he do it? The great mysteries. And then, of course, the issue of, although we're going to talk, of course, what he accomplished at the seminary and what, but what this led to in terms of the Orthodox response to him and not just to Lieberman, but the whole issue of the conservative movement, mid-century America, how was one to view this? What about all the other Orthodox people who are teaching there? We're going to get into some really fundamental issues in terms of how Orthodoxy viewed itself vis-a-vis the conservative movement, and especially an Orthodoxy that was being, unlike today, where Orthodoxy is the one triumphant. And I don't just mean in terms of birth rate. I mean in terms of everything. If in the 1940s, 1950s, it was the conservative movement that was the future. Suburban Jews were flocking to the conservative movement, and Orthodoxy did not look like it had much of a future. So all sorts of great stuff we're going to get to. Let me take the questions and comments now. Cohen says that Rabbi Mendelitz wasn't working as a rabbi, but trying to earn a living. Yes, you are correct. He was not with great success until he was invited to Tor Vadas. That is correct. Scranton was a Hungarian Jewish community. So I said he's from Slovakia, but Slovakia used to be Hungary, larger Hungary. So the synagogue, just a couple blocks from where I'm sitting now, Machzik Yadas, originally was Hungarian synagogue, and you had a few others. And why they came to Scranton, I don't know. And none of them worked in the mines, but they provided the clothing and the stores for the miners. As far as I know, there never was a Jewish miner in Scranton, but I stand to be corrected if there was one. Rabbi Kelman. Oh, he's giving instructions. Thank you for that, Rabbi Shu. Ruth says, I have Lieberman's Tosefta Zuckerman, a print in Israel from my grandfather's library. The dedication is to Harry Fishel, Ben Shivim Mishtayim, 72 years old. And his title is Rosh Machon. Yeah, thank you. That's what I just said. So that's the one I mentioned, Ruth, that if you look in, he has, it's really like an introduction to the Tosefta. There you go, holding it up. Very nice. And wait till you see it. Lieberman, he felt, well, as I'll explain to you, he felt this personal connection to Harry Fishel. He felt like by going back to Israel and by leaving Israel, he was betraying Harry Fishel. And I learned something just yesterday that even in 1945, Lieberman was still regarded as the dean. I'll show you why I say this, of the Harry Fishel Institute. But he's writing in 1985, which is the 80th birthday of Harry Fishel. We'll see what he writes about him. He dies in 48. He's buried. You can go see he's buried in the Mount of Olives. He has a big, you can't get in because it's locked. I guess they only open up at yurt sites, but in the Mount of Olives, he has a big ohel, they call it. It's not a tent, like the Chassidish Rebbe's have. I don't know if you can go to the Mount of Olives now, though. I went about 5-6 years ago, and later I was told that I was crazy, that it's dangerous. I was there by myself. I went to Rav Cook's grave, not just Rav Cook, all of the people, it's Rav his son, the whole Rav Cook followers are there, and I found all sorts of other people who I had no idea were buried there. And later I was told that it was a very dangerous thing, that the only time you should go to Mount of Olives is go when there's a big gathering of people. But, okay. Rabbi Shugnow says that Max Kedushin said that Mishra Gadal, the same sage's contradictory positions, one after the other. Rabbi Kelman, I'm not sure what Asher Reimer is alluding to. Maybe I'll explain. Rabbi Kelman, you can link on him. He has a discussion there about Rav's bride for the night. Rabbi Kelman has that's the sort of thing where it's hard to, how do you explain this to people today? It's unless you're going to say that, you know, a different conception, but Rabbi Duner thought this was some heretic put that in. Gershon says he heard that the Rav criticized Lieberman for regarding all manuscripts with scholarly deference, not realizing that even Rishoni made mistakes. Yes, Gershon, we will get to this. That's the big dispute between Rabbi Soloveitchik and Lieberman at the wedding, at the bris, when the Tuma of Asheretz. We'll get to this. We spoke about it last semester. We'll get to it as well, where the Rav says that even Rishonim could he didn't say make mistakes. He says you could have some medievals who are ignoramuses. Just because a medieval writes something, he could be an ignoramus. He says there's ignoramuses today, there's ignoramuses then. We will get to that because I won't, as I told you last semester, I can now explain exactly what Lieberman was referring to. I can explain. Thanks to Shama Friedman, I can tell you what he was talking about. Zev says learning too much Torah may lead to heresy, might be alluding to Kabbalah. I don't know. It doesn't say that. Then it's a, you know, it's a midrash. So I don't know if it would. It could. Learning too much Kabbalistic stuff can lead to heresy. We've seen that. But maybe. I don't know. Rabbi Shudnow says Harry Fishel saved YU from merging to JTS. I don't know if that's really true, Rabbi Shudnow, because at the end of the day, they had the discussions and Mordechai Kaplan was a sticking point. And even if they didn't have the money, would they ever have been able to join? As it is, it was hard. YU, it wasn't called YU then, it was Yeshiva College. They had to sell a lot of land that they own then. And I'll just say, now I know who, although he didn't make it public, but I know who knew the Latin there. So I guess it comes from all the Scrabble he plays, and shkoyach to that. Barry says, Rabbi Barry, when Lieberman and Chazon Ish lived in the 30s in Israel, what was the connection between the two? I assume that Lieberman visited, but I have no proof of that. It's hard to imagine that he just would send letters. He must have visited him. That's what I'm assuming. If you look in, I'll show you next class with Spiro, when they talk about the different Gedolim, Lieberman, and his relationship with them in Eretz Yisrael. Although I'll show you next class that he makes the make mistakes through on Shochet, because they refer to a Rabbi El Yoshev and Lieberman. It's not Rav Yosef Shalom El Yoshev, which is what they say it is. No, he was a young man. He's referring to the grandfather of Yosef Shalom El Yoshev. That's the Makubo of Shlomo El Yoshev, the Leshem he's called. I'll get to that next class. Paul Shaviv, side note, Joseph Hochstein was the grandson-in-law, of the Ramaz. So who's the son-in-law? I thought, you're right, he's the, why did I think he was the son-in-law? There was the dynasty. If you look in, but thank you for pointing that out. Yes, they take a lot of pride, obviously. You're right, it was his, I guess, what do you call that, the grandfather-in-law. But if you look in one of the books, I think it's the book on fraud, corruption, holiness, Gastwort. He talks about Rabbi Ramaz, the Ramaz. He stood up very strongly against these corrupt butchers and everything. And at his daughter's wedding, I think it's in the Gastwort book, if I'm not mistaken, they poisoned the wedding, literally poisoned the food. No one fortunately died, but as their revenge, we know that these butchers, story is they locked the Ridbaz of when he was in Chicago, they locked him in the freezer. And then he was so afraid for his life, he had to leave Chicago on Shabbos. That's a true story. If it's not, I think it's in Gastwort. If it's not there, it's in another authentic source. And they assumed, everyone got food poisoning and some were serious and they assumed it was done intentionally. And who else would do it? Mike says Rabbi Dov's grandson, Avraham Yitzchak Cook, was recently named to Muetzes Gedolia Torah. Yeah, there's a Haredi, you'll see this Haredi rabbi. I didn't hear that he was named to the Muetzes Gedolia Torah. But as you said, he's the son of a Rafael Cook. But you have, there's a Rabbi Yehuda Cook and there's an Avraham Yitzchak Cook. And you'll see them cited in Yatei Ne'aman and all the Haredi things. And but it's not, and from what I'm told, that they do have respect for Simcha Cohen Cook. He's another cook. At least he, I know, has great respect for Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook. I don't know. I assume they do. But they are not direct descendants of Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook. Because Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook did not have any children, as we know. So let me see. I think there's one more thing I want to show you. He's incidentally Rabbi Simcha Cohen Cook. He now, I believe, he was made rabbi of the Churva Synagogue. He's also a son of Rabbi Rafael Cook. If you go to the Churva Synagogue, I guess you can meet him. Other than that, that is it for me. I thank you all for coming here. I just wish you, I don't know if Raquel's with us, so I'll wish you all, you know, we should be sealed, that next year should be a good year, and you know, that, God willing, 1 year from now, we'll be looking, this will be in our back window, looking back. So just be safe, obviously, on Rosh Hashanah, and we'll pick it up, I guess. Kelman, are you with us to say your goodbyes? If not, I'll take the honors. Okay, everyone. Good night.